You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Mention of Somalia invokes images of war, famine, and pirates. It's been at the top of the failed states list for years. But throughout all of the instability and violence there, Dr. Hawa Abdi has worked to provide medical care and safety to thousands of her countrymen and women, prompting some to call her the Mother Teresa of Somalia. Her book, Keeping Hope Alive, One Woman, 90,000 Lives Changed, is published by Grand Central, and she joins us now along with her oldest daughter, Deko. I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hello.
Hello. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you.
Dr. Abdi, you were one of the first female doctors in Somalia. What led you to medicine?
The situation in Somalia, especially my mother, died when I was young. And I could not know what she had. It was delivery complication. Then that time, my mother was feeling a terrible pain. It was very painful for me when I saw how she was suffering.
And there were no doctors to take her to?
There were doctors, Italian doctors that time. But they did not care so many.
And then
I decided to be a doctor after my mother died.
And then your grandmother died not long after. Then your father died when you were studying medicine.
Yes.
Your sister, Amina, died when you were young.
Yeah.
You lost so many people close to you.
Yes, yes. Then in 2005 also died my son, who was 24 years age. Already man, big man, but died by car accident.
Now, Somalia, go ahead.
And this book was dedicated to my brother.
So. Now, Somalia is a pretty traditional society. Are women encouraged to go into medicine?
At that time, but my father was a man, educated man, and he had four daughters. And he believed that his daughters can do what men do. And he sent me to Soviet Union at that time. We did not have so much. No, we did not know so much their lives, but to have a scholarship was very difficult. Then they gave me a scholarship. Women, Moscow, Women Committee, Soviet Union at that time. So it was chance.
And it was your intention to return to Somalia to practice medicine.
Yes, yes, yes. I want to return. My intention was to help the other children, to protect the pain I feel when my mother died. Others to help do not die their mothers. What could I do? I was trying to do.
Well, there were only 60 doctors in all of Somalia when you returned to work in Mogadishu.
Yeah.
Didn't you want to be a surgeon at first? How did you end up starting in pediatrics?
That was very important. But I came and I liked to be a surgeon. But the man who was our director says, what we need now is pediatric, because children are dying 11%. In Somalia, till now.
And so that was probably good training for you.
Yes,
working with
good training. I saved many children at that time.
And then you decided to go to law school. Were you thinking of quitting medicine?
No, I was just trying to help the people and myself. The health is very important. And the law also, to defend your right. And rights of the other vulnerable groups.
I think the higher and the difficulties of injustice was going on at that time. Practicing in the government, she decided to learn more. She never practiced as an attorney much, but she learned to defend herself and others.
Well, was it possible at the time, we're talking about the early 70s, to stay clear of politics in Somalia?
Not. That was, at that time, our government said that we are socialism, scientific socialism, they said. And still the lawyers and the jurisdiction people were trying to debate their rights. And I was one of them.
And you had to sing songs in support of the government every day at the morning meeting of doctors
yes,
in the
yes.
hospital.
Yes, yes, yes.
So, but then you started a family to complicate things. And is that when you decided to move out of the city?
Yes, yes. It was very difficult that already coming to fail the government.
Oh, so you would try to get away from the government, but
from the city.
And you were going to run a farm,
yes,
raise a family, and also be a doctor. Were you going to practice law as well?
I was practicing law after I finished law, and I had already 2 degrees, medical degree and law degree. We went outside the Mogadishu because at that time already beginning the civil war, the government becoming already weak and weak. Violence was increasing, so we wanted to go outside in our farm.
And you were practicing medicine. Were you practicing in a hospital at the time?
At the time, I was teaching. I was a teacher, assistant professor of medical, Somali University Medical School.
And then you decided to open a clinic on your land.
Yes.
Was your husband, Aiden, supportive of
yes,
that idea?
Yes, he was supporting me.
And Deko, you went with your mother to help her out. You carried equipment?
Yes.
How old were you?
I think I was 6 or 7 when we first opened in the clinic. I was very little, but we were very excited to be outside, having a farm and running around. It was very exciting. But sometimes we missed the city because we pulled out from the city. But I think it worked well. We did enjoy it and grew differently.
And your mother was pregnant at the time.
My mother was pregnant.
Was that when you decided to become a doctor yourself?
Not really. I always want to be a historian or write stories or be a reporter or something like that. I my turn on was, the time I decided to become a doctor was when Civil War broke out, when I have seen how difficult people, how my mother was struggling. She needed help on that time in many ways. She was the only doctor, and we had a lot of people coming in wounded, delivering all complications. So that's when I decided to become a doctor.
My guests are Deko Abdi is with
Deko
you.
Mohammed.
Deko Mohammed.
Dr. Hawa Abdi, who's written a book called Keeping Hope Alive with the help of Sarah J. Robbins. Dr. Abdi, when did you get the idea of to start a clinic?
It was 1983 with one room.
You just saw that this great need?
Just it was a great need for the women in labor.
And in this case, it could be your own, and you didn't have to worry about all the internal politics that you had to deal with when you were in the hospital in Mogadishu.
No.
This was yours.
It was mine.
But weren't you seeing more patients than you ever would have in a hospital?
At first, not 7, 5, 8 per day. But after a few months, the news spread, and the patients come till 100 patients per day.
100 patients?
Yeah.
That's running a small, in fact, not such a small hospital on your own.
Yes, but it was most was OBD, the outpatient dispensary I was using. There was no admission at that time.
Did you have any help? Were there other doctors there? This is.
I had a doctress. I was teaching at university then. In practice, I was coming to our big hospital, Banadir. And we were working together with Chinese doctors, with Somali doctors. Sometimes I was transferring patients which need this operation to Banadir Hospital. And we were operating. Sometimes they were coming me after I have built a theater.
You had an operating theater as well.
The first I did not have a theater to operate.
And you were using, in some cases, methods used by traditional healers in addition to modern medical techniques. Did you do that because people were suspicious of modern medicine?
I think so. In many ways, to try to understand and welcome them and say, okay, yeah, it's acceptable, but let's try. But this is better. So because we were in the heart of rural area, so to get the people to the traditional and, you know, and modern medicine was very difficult.
And you also, she also had to convince people to trust a woman doctor.
Definitely.
So, but some of those traditional healing methods can be dangerous, can't they?
Can be, but she hasn't tried everything as extended. It's just a simple thing. Sometimes they have leaves, like a tree leaves, they drink and feel they're feeling better. So when you know a couple of trees are not harmful so much, you can try in that way to persuade them, but not exactly following everything.
So you give them the traditional treatment, and then you say, and let's try this other thing too.
Yes.
But I know that this traditional medicine was healing better than modern medicine.
Psychologically.
Uh-huh.
Not psychologically, really. So I was using the traditional medicine, which was healed at many years ago for our society, and there is no side effect, big side effect, no.
So Western medicine, you think, has something to learn from? I know we talk about learning from the people in the Amazon, because they have all of these plants that have healing powers. The same would be true if we consulted traditional healers in Somalia and other parts of the world?
Our government at that time, they were supporting traditional healers.
Uh-huh. Now
that they were trying to combine modern medicine and traditional healers.
Well, you say our government, there was a civil war going on at the time,
yeah,
wasn't
not,
there?
Not. There was the doctors, you know, senior doctors, and Minister of Health also was a doctor.
Mm-hmm. That was before civil war.
Before civil war, because 1983. And civil war broke out in 90.
But there was already violence, and people started coming
to
your farm.
Yes,
as a place of refuge as well, not just as a place to get medical treatment?
Medical treatment, and even they were leaving. Sometimes they fled from Mogadishu when they have, you know, at night they were capturing people. Sometimes, and that person was killed. They found his family. Body. So many already fled from Mogadishu.
And then your husband was arrested in 1988. What reason was given for the arrest?
Somalia has a northern part of Somalia and southern part of Somalia. He was some northern part of Somalia. At that time, northern part till now. They don't like the southern part of Somalia. They want to be separate. And the government did not like these bad things. They have a violent group.
Well, Teiko, the violence was based on clan membership, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's what she's trying to say.
There are members of, there are four major clans. Weren't they, before the violence, encouraged to intermarry as a way of settling disputes?
Yes. Yes, it was beautiful, but since the civil, you know, the cities developed, the civil society developed, the country was new, what means governance. Before we didn't have, we just got independence in the early 60s, and right after a decade of our independence in 70s, we start fighting. Because this thing is the new thing introduced to society. It's the power, it's the city, it's the money, so things they didn't had before. So that created the clash and misunderstanding on everybody. Okay, I want to be in the power. So my clan supposed to be the leader. So it caused a very tough time.
How come independence came so late to Somalia?
I think it came same as most of Africa, 1960s.
Oh, the 60s.
Yes.
And the colonial power had been what?
Left the Italian, and we had British also for a long time in northern part and south for Italian. So, and there's a division, but Somali started a fight very soon, right after we were not like rest of African countries were developing better. We had a wonderful time for a couple of decades, but all went down to the hill when we started fighting with Ethiopia in 1977 and creating the neighbors and feeling, okay, we have a power, we need to take more.
My guests are Dr. Hawa Abdi and her daughter, Deko, and we are talking about the situation in Somalia and Dr. Abdi's story, which she tells in a book called Keeping Hope Alive, One Woman, 90,000 Lives Changed. It's published by Grand Central. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We are back with Dr. Hawa Abdi, who, with the help of Sarah J. Robbins, has written Keeping Hope Alive, a book that is published by, what's the name of the publisher here? Grand Central. And also with us is her daughter, Dr. Deko Muhammad. We're talking about this extraordinary life that you've had. It's just amazing. English is not your first language. It's not your second language. So you're doing very well in speaking English. How many other languages do you speak?
I speak Russian language, Italian language, my own mother tongue, Somali language.
And then English.
And more little bit English.
And Deko, you speak English a little better because you've been living in the United States for a while?
Yeah, not for a while. It's about 4 years.
Uh-huh. You came here to escape the violence?
Yes.
Now, the Civil War broke out in 1991, although you say there's sometimes no clear distinction between peace and war. Then in the middle of that year, there were more than 4,000 people living on your land. Were you feeding them all out of your funds and from your farm?
I gave them a land to live and water to drink, but food was providing international NGOs like ICRC, like World Food Program. I was going to ask, they were coming, doing a survey, then they were giving us food. Dry rations was getting.
So this is being treated, your farm, as a refugee camp, in a sense.
Yes, yes, yes.
And Deko, you were 16 at the time. Were you still going to school, or were you just working to help feed everybody?
We were going to school and homeschool in different ways, because I was in last grade when the war broke out in 1991. And definitely, we were feeding everyone. Since they arrive in our door, we have to oblige to, as a tradition, as a part of the family, to host our guests.
Well, what were they living in? Tents?
They live in the beginning in hospital, but when hospital, part of hospital, behind of a hospital get full, they were living under the trees. They built their own tents, then UNHCR, United Nations Refugee Funds, came to us and was providing to them shelters, you know, giving us the plastic sheets so they can build little huts and homes and so they can come.
You would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to help make breakfast.
Definitely, in the beginning.
Now, refugee camps are often unsafe places. Did you have guards to protect people, especially women who are often vulnerable to rape?
Yep. We had to, because it was very, you had open camp where you inviting everyone and you don't know who's coming to you, so you have to protect people. They're under our protection.
Dr. Abdi, was the camp often harassed? How did you handle the men who came to the camp with guns in their hands making demands?
Making demands to search another clan to kill, because they were fighting by clans. It was very difficult.
They would point a gun at you?
Yes.
And then what would you say?
I said, I was respected among my society. So who had gun was the boys of my fellow people.
But you must have been scared, even if you were able to stand them down.
Yes, because people ran to me. I was only one person, one woman. But they think that I can protect them. So I have to do something. I said, please, son, go back. They said, we want those people who's inside the hospital.
And they wanted them because they were just in another clan? Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I say, no, you are not going to see these people. First, you have to kill me. Then maybe you go and kill them. Because your profession is only killing, and that is not job. You are a young man. Please go and study and work to yourself.
You think any of them took your advice?
So I think she turns on her hat, she puts on her hat of being grandma. You look, you know, and definitely it helps. I don't know, that's the power. When you are in very difficult situations, she shines. When we are normal, she's very quiet. You know, when there's any conflict, she shines and she becomes strong and she stands up against.
But you also,
all odds.
You also had to suddenly step forward. How old were you when you delivered a baby for the first time? Your mother was ill.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was, I think, 16 that time, right after the war broke out. And I was just watching the midwife was very busy that night. We had a lot of deliveries. And she told me, just watch it when the baby is closed. Just call me. And it was too soon. I couldn't call her. So I had to. Actually, the lady who was giving the birth helped me. She just told me to hold the child. Don't panic. Make sure the child didn't fall on the floor. So I was 16.
And then you started delivering babies on a regular basis?
Yes. I saw the high need, so I learned as a TPA, traditional, you know, birth, and with my mom's help to deliver and support them.
And Dr. Abdi, when did Doctors Without Borders begin working with you?
2007.
Recently, 2007.
And that must have helped. It eased some
helpful.
Of the pressure.
It was helpful.
Were so many women and children there because of your hospital, or was it because of the camp?
Yes, it was most crowded place in my camp that time. There was a watery diarrhea, which we would have always, or cholera, every year broke out. And they come to me, they helped really. They gave the tent, they gave the solution, they tried to do a shelter that people, children with watery diarrhea.
I think
diarrhea is a big problem.
Yes. I think we had two very important essential points for life. We had water. We had walls. So one thing people attract is to live where close to water. And we had health care. So that the one is main attraction to our camp, to the people. And we had a free land where they can stay. So they had a very good point to be overcrowded.
And they trusted you, Dr. Abdi. They called you mama.
Yes.
But that must have, all of the stress, it must have had an effect
had
on your health.
A big stress, but my society or the people trusted me.
Yeah, it did help. It did affect her health in many ways.
My guests are Dr. Hawa Abdi, her book, Keeping Hope Alive. It's published by Grand Central. And her daughter, Dr. Deko Muhammad. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So the situation got dangerous enough that you sent your children away. You sent them to Kenya, to Nairobi. Not exactly the safest city in the world, is
not
it?
Not the safest city.
But better?
It's better than Somalia. Comparing to Somalia, it seems the safest city in the world when you just came out from Somalia. And I think the main goal was for her to study. We have to get education.
And
we cannot just sit.
And you followed your mother into, it was no longer the Soviet Union, but to Russia, mm-hmm. to go to medical school?
Yes.
So I
graduated from Moscow in 2003 with my obstetric gynecology. I got my MD in 2000, then I added my postgraduate residency program in 3 years. So it was wonderful. It's long, 10 years being in cold. But I think mission accomplished.
Well, it prepared you for the cold of parts of the United States as well, although it never gets as cold as it does in Russia. Dr. Abdi, you were kidnapped in 2010 by members of the insurgent group Hezbollah Islam. They're connected to Al Shabaab.
I don't know that, but they come and they kidnapped me.
Had they been harassing the camp before then?
No, they come to me and they say, please hand over this job. We will take over this camp and this hospital. I say, why? They say, you are women and also old women.
So this
we are men and young. We can run this. I say, this is my private property. And people come to me, not to you.
Well, you, was it part of the problem that you're a woman? Did they see that as a problem? Was this a religious thing?
Not exactly religious. Muslim religion is not that.
But that's what they thought. That's the goal of taking over the camp because you're a woman.
What did you and your sister Amina do when you heard about the attack?
Apparently, harassment was going so long, but my mom was sickly. She hasn't told us. So I left on the day after I left, next day the attack happened. She told us to go and do some work and try to do some fundraising. So we both left within a week, and the attack happened. She knew they will come.
Now, Dr. Abdi, they took you and some of the nurses where?
They took me and other four nurses. They put a hole to us. They put a mattresses and a carpet. We sat there at 8 o'clock. We were thinking too much because we did not know what they want to do to us.
And I imagine that the people in the camp. Weren't all that happy that suddenly there was a new regime.
Yes. No, they did not take over the camp because many people, Somali people, diaspora and inside Somalia, they were calling 24 hours, why you attack that hospital? There is no military. There is no people who fight with you. There is only patients and children.
So how were you freed? I mean, other than that there was a ransom of 100 camels.
I think we freed through media. The ransom of 100 camels was for one of their soldiers was killed in attack. And that was their fault. They killed themselves. So we, as a tradition in Somalia, if you take a life, you ransom 100 camels. That was the case, but on her case being kidnapped with her nurses and held in a room, the way we freed her, it's using the media. We try to call as much as we can. We try to air every radio that available to the community inside and outside and international and UN. We reached everywhere. So we put in the pressure outside, so they released her in that way.
Although it wasn't a totally happy ending, they destroyed your home. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The school was closed.
Yeah.
Eventually,
hospital was closed.
Doctors Without Borders left because they felt
there
their staff
no
was
security,
threatened.
There was no security. Yes, there was no security at all.
So, how long did it take you to recover?
Oh, till now we did not recover well.
Do you feel you're still under threat because the situation in Somalia is still quite unstable?
Yes, quite unstable. Yes, that is true.
But you also say that the demonstration of the loyalty of
the people
in the camp really
camp
was what saved you.
There was no more water, no more school, no more hospital, health care. And local media came to the camp. And they ask the society, what has happened in your place? They said, Hezbollah Islam come, they kidnapped our Mama Hawa, and now we have nothing.
So what's the situation today? How many people are on your land?
Today it's better. I just came a week ago in Somalia in the camp. So the situation is improving. First time Somalia, we voted. We had a election and we had a president for 22 years, first time. So the condition is improving, the security is getting better, and people are coming back. We had a clash for end of last year, the fight between Al-Shabaab and the government. It happened right in hospital, and the hospital again get damaged and looted and all that. So now we're having construction, people are coming back. We do have over 5,600 residency in the camp, but we're still serving over 90,000 for healthcare in the surrounding cities.
90,000 people, yes. That's a lot of people to serve.
As much as we can.
That is true. And a lot of people, but that is what we cannot change, nothing. We are there, they are seeing us, there's a hospital, they are coming. We cannot close the eyes. We have to do something for them.
Is there an organization in this country that supports you?
Many of them, actually. We have the
Vital Voices supports yes. us.
And people can also visit your website, dhaf.org.
Yeah.
Yes.
I thank you both so much for being on our show today. I've been speaking with Dr. Hawa Abdi, who has been nominated for a Nobel Prize, no surprise. She has written, with the help of Sarah J. Robbins, Keeping Hope Alive, One Woman, 90,000 Lives Changed, and it is published by the Grand Central. And also here is Dr. Deko Muhammad, who lives now where?
In Somalia.
Oh, you're back in Somalia?
Yes.
Thank you both for coming to New York.
Thank you.
And being on my show.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. And thank you for hosting.